President Obama's budget request included a small $5 million item earmarked for a next-generation fighter. And while no one knows exactly what it'll be, it's meant to replace the F/A-18 Super Hornet and EA-18 Growler by 2030. And what's more, for more on what exactly the new fighter might be capable of, why it's needed, and the program implications of all of that, we turn to Jerry Hendricks. He's a senior fellow and director of the Defense Strategies and Assessments Program at the Center for a New American Security. Mr. Hendricks, thanks for joining me.
It's good to be here. How are you today?
All right. So I guess the question, first question I have is, with the fifth generation fighter barely off the deck, as it were, why is the military thinking about the next one? Or is this common to think this far out?
Well, I think actually it hasn't been historically common, but if you look at the difficulties in getting the Joint Strike Fighter or the fifth generation Bird off the ground, the fact that this is, you know, a design that reaches back some 15 years, then we're probably not too early to begin thinking about what comes next. But there's also, I think, a couple other aspects that are driving into this. One is that there is a competing type of aircraft that's also under consideration right now, which is the U-class, or an unmanned aircraft for the aircraft carrier that could also serve either ISR or strike missions. And so I think there's a desire by naval aviation to go ahead and get the next manned aircraft going before U-class steps in and perhaps swallows up more of the budget than what is expected. But I think there's another aspect in that we're seeing competing nations also looking to take that next step. China is looking at a sixth-generation fighter right now. And so in order for the Navy to remain competitive in the aerial environment, I think that they want to make these investments now and begin looking ahead.
And so with the F-35 still basically conventional and doesn't fly all that far, could all of these different initiatives possibly trim back what was envisioned originally to be a very large fleet of these current fifth-generation ones, again, as we mentioned, are still not quite ready for prime time?
I think that there's actually some dissatisfaction with the F-35 program, at least on the from the Navy. The Navy has traditionally always favored a dual-engine aircraft. There's nothing like being over the water with a single engine and worrying about a mechanical breakdown. And this is a sort of a historical pattern. Whenever a joint aircraft has been attempted to be forced upon the Navy pushes back. The F-111 was originally conceived back in the 1960s to be the dual Air Force and Navy aircraft, and it just wasn't suitable for the carrier environment. And the Navy has been somewhat hesitant with the maintenance issues associated with the F-35. So I think that there's some individuals within the Navy's leadership that would love to see the F-35 buy truncated and then look at something to come next that perhaps is more readily adaptable to the maritime environment. We have to remember the maritime environment is a very salty, it's a very corrosive environment. The landing on an aircraft carrier and taking off an aircraft carrier requires a very robust aircraft, and that is not necessarily in line with perhaps, you know, having the Air Force model as well as the Marine Corps model. Now, the Navy's version is much more robust. The landing gear and the tail assembly for where the tail hook goes is a much more robust, but it adds a lot of weight and hence decreases range. And so right now the Navy is in a fight to buy back range as they begin looking at an anti-access, air-denied environment. And so the 35, which can only reach out to about 600 nautical miles, isn't really going to get that job done.
All right, so when you look at the existing planes, which I guess the Navy uses now, the F-18 variants, I guess there's been about six or seven generations of those, can that tide over the Navy if it decided, well, maybe the F-35 isn't really for us, but could the F-18 do this for until this sixth generation plane comes along?
Well, I think that there's an option for that. Certainly when the Congress put in money to buy additional EF-18Gs, the Growlers, to keep the Boeing assembly line open, then we have the option to buy additional F-18s into the future that could perhaps make that bridge to get us forward. The question is what is it that we really need to buy next? One of the options that's out there is to actually make the UCAV, or the Unmanned Combat Aerial Vehicle, the F-A-XX, make it fit those requirements. And unmanned actually is the opportunity that we need to look at if we really want to buy range. One of the great limiting factors in an aircraft is the man, and one of the limiting factors that we look at with the man in particular is how long they can sit in an ejection seat outfitted aircraft. And a lot of studies have looked at and said, you know, between 10 to 12 hours, the man really becomes ineffective. And so when you're looking at a 1,000 nautical mile range mission, you know, you're going to see some degradation in the man's abilities to operate.
Yeah, because I guess those seats are really not much more than a coach seat on United Airlines, really, in terms of space and comfort.
Actually, they're a lot less comfortable. They're a solid, hard, molded plastic. And essentially, after about 10 hours, you know, your legs fall asleep and really become desensitized. And you get very tired. It's a very confined environment with no getting up and walking around.
We're speaking with Jerry Hendricks. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the Defense Strategies and Assessments Program at the Center for New American Security. And so the unmanned aspect then means that with aerial refueling and the ability to change shifts of operators back wherever they sit, you know, in a room somewhere, that you could have something that could fly indefinitely.
Well, and actually it's not indefinitely. When we looked at this, there's actually been studies done. We believe that an unmanned aircraft can remain airborne for up to 50 hours. And in the 50 hours, you actually run into a situation where you have to change out the lubricating oils on some of the larger mechanisms. These are not sort of the high-altitude unmanned assets that can go up for days. These are more combat-sturdy. The engines turn at a higher RPM, and the surfaces of the aircraft that maneuver it have to be lubricated on a more consistent basis. And so, but we look at a 50-hour mission time for some of these packages to go up, you know, with some aerial refueling, and in fact, some of the unmanned can perhaps even refuel themselves within an air wing. So that certainly is an option as we look at FAXX. But I think naval aviation, if we look at the leadership's hints right now, they would much rather prefer a manned aircraft. The difficulty they're going to run into with the requirements process, especially with technocrats like Robert Work as the Deputy Secretary of Defense and Ashton Carter as the Secretary of Defense, is those guys are going to look at hard numbers. Carter, in particular, is a scientist, a PhD-level physicist, and he's going to look at how this is going to work. And I think that the Navy's going to run into a big skeptical buzzsaw when they try to push a manned aircraft into the sixth-generation role.
Yeah, I guess you're really looking toward the future. You might as well look totally towards the future, in other words.
That's correct. And one of the options that's out there, going back to what you were saying earlier about possibly truncating F-35, is, you know, some of the cost savings, if we didn't buy the full load of F-35s and we extended the F-18 Hornet line, there's a significant net cost savings that could be invested in the unmanned platform, pulling it forward and getting it into production quicker.
All right, so how do these things tend to get resolved? Because you've got cultural issues, as you mentioned, and you've got the Navy pushing, and it's got its adherents in Congress and so forth. And then you say, as you mentioned, the technocrats are the people that look at this strictly, you know, from a slide rule perspective. What is the process by which the nature of this next generation device gets decided?
Well, the Navy will put forward its proposals in its budgetary submissions, as it's already begun to do. This $5 million investment that they requested in their budget is simply the first step. But that will also have to be looked at by the Office of the Secretary of Defense, will have to be looked at in the Capabilities and Program Evaluation Office, as well as the Science and Technology Office, headed up by Undersecretary Frank Kendall. Those decisions or recommendations will be forward and vetted and sent forward to the Deputy Secretary, as well as the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as part of a board that they will sit and convene as they look at the requirements. And then they will make a series of endorsements, probably push back to the services a couple times, and then final recommendations would come forward to a secretary. And then, I think this is the time when people who have a real technical look at these things, like Bob Work and Ashton Carter, I think that they're going to take a look at it and then come down heavily on that significant investment in the future, especially as we look at the things that Bob Work has had to say about the Offset 3 strategy that he's been promoting for the last couple months.
Yes, you've just began to answer my next question, and that is the Offset strategy. Wouldn't that ideally have some input into what this next generation aircraft would be like?
Yes, I think it will, and I think that that's the type of technology that Mr. Work has been looking for, at least tacitly suggesting over the last several years, both, you know, first when he was an analyst at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, then when he was the Undersecretary of the Navy, and then finally now as the Deputy Secretary of Defense, is that he's looking for these key technologies that are not just going to continue to evolve the force, but to perhaps revolutionize the force by getting leap-ahead technologies that put us on a new plateau that buy us, if not another generation, at least another decade of leadership in the environment. So you look at unmanned as clearly an area that he's had a strong interest in, and then you look at directed energy, you look at electromagnetics, you look at cyber, which is there, and I think all those things, quite frankly, could come in and have some role to play in these aircraft of the future.
But it's safe to say that when you proceed from an unmanned basis, then a lot of other costs never get developed. They're avoided from the outset for forever, correct?
That's a very insightful point, because one of the things you look at with unmanned, one, you're going to lower life cycle cost. Right now, as you look at the current carrier air wing, nearly 80 to 85% of an aircraft's life in a carrier air wing is spent maintaining the currency of the pilot, meaning getting him up, putting him into the pattern so that he gets his day landing qualifications, he gets his night landing qualifications, then he does all the other exercises he needs in the warfare areas. With an unmanned, presumably, those qualifications for the pilot can occur in a simulator, and in fact, you don't have to burn the airframe's life in the pattern around the boat. The airframe would essentially be brought out for the missions. After the completion of the mission, the airframe is landed, folded back up, put down in the hangar bay where it can be maintained in a safer environment for the longer haul. And so we would actually see the airframes last a lot longer with a lower life cycle cost. Presumably as well, we would be lowering the cost of the operators, the pilots themselves, into the future. And so I think that we really would shatter the paradigm on what the overall cost of the carrier and its operations would be going forward. And in fact, I think we would have to look at just how many carriers we would require in that environment. It presumably would not be as many as the 11 that right now are congressionally mandated by law.
And a final question, the $5 million in the 2016 budget, what does that actually buy? Just a look-see or maybe some kind of a concept of a contest between a couple of different builders?
I think it's just an internal look-see. I don't think that $5 million really could even fund any type of a contest amongst the builders. I think this is just a development of CONOPS and laying out what the requirements would be for that vehicle. So I think that we're essentially going to ask, what altitude, what range, how long we want to fly, and we're going to ask the internal experts within the building to take a look at that.
Jerry Hendricks, a senior fellow and director of the Defense Strategies and Assessments Program at the Center for a New American Security. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.